Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would it take for you to plant yourself in the path of an oncoming tornado? Would you do it if it led to greater scientific understanding of these storms, or would the thrill of living through it be enough motivation? While we've been focusing a lot on earthquakes in recent days, tornado season is an annual reminder in North Texas of how quickly and indiscriminately disaster can strike. The more accurately we can predict and track these storms, the more warning we might have the danger is imminent. My guests are keenly aware of the destructive potential of tornadoes and the need for reliable forecasting, and they have extensive firsthand experience with the seductive allure of storm chasing. Sean Casey is a filmmaker who directed the documentary Tornado Alley, which opens this weekend at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science. Donald Burgess is among the scientists featured in the film. He works at the Cooperative Institute for Mesoscale Meteorological Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and he, too, is a storm chaser with the Vortex II Mobile Radar Project. Welcome, guys, to Think.
Yeah, well, thanks. You.
Would you call yourselves obsessed by tornadoes?
I would say we're obsessed with storms mm-hmm. and the beauty of nature and the power of nature.
I actually am obsessed with tornadoes. Yeah, it's something otherworldly, really, when you have this massive destructive thing in front of you. And there's this also natural beauty to them. It's such a kind of exotic crossroads. I still can't really still wrap my mind around that they exist. Still, I mean, they seem just completely surreal to me. So
I spent way too much time after watching the film, after doing my research, way too much time online looking for beautiful storm photographs, because we know they're destructive, and I don't want to take anything away from people who've experienced that, but there is something, I mean, they almost look like works of art, but they're created entirely by nature.
Yeah, I completely agree. They are works of the art, and they are destructive. And, you know, Don and I, we have the opportunity, you know, Don to study them for the first part, and me to film them. I'm the filmmaker, I guess. To be that close to them, it's kind of like this weird honor, and it doesn't feel like you should be there. It feels like you've gotten too close to something you should be farther away from, and you have this front row seat of just this awesome beauty.
Don, what is a tornado exactly?
Well, the official definition is a violently rotating column of air in contact with the ground, and has the potential to do damage.
So they're not always the things that we think we can see? I mean, is it possible to have a tornado that's not visible to the human eye?
Yes, it is. We tend to associate tornadoes with condensation funnels. But that condensation funnel is just where the pressure drops enough for clouds to condense. And if a tornado is maybe just starting, or if it's in a drier environment, you might have that rotation at the ground and doing damage, and yet maybe just a very small funnel cloud high up near cloud base or no funnel cloud at all. So what you have to watch out for is that swirl of dust and debris at the ground.
Why is this part of the country in particular susceptible?
Well, it's the title of the film, Tornado Alley. We're the place where the ingredients for tornadoes meet together most often. The warm, moist air from the Gulf of Mexico, strong jet stream from west to east, and then cold fronts or dry lines, boundaries that get vertical motion and thunderstorms going.
Sean, you had done a film back in 2000 for IMAX about weather. Is that right?
Yeah, we did a IMAX film called Forces of Nature mm-hmm. with National Geographic, and that covered earthquakes, volcanoes, and tornadoes.
So. Goodness, volcanoes are the one thing we don't have yet in North Texas. Let's hope that continues that way. We've been dealing with earthquakes lately. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll talk about that later. But you weren't entirely happy with the tornado footage that you had from that film? Or hooked?
That was my first time chasing. And, you know, I'm from Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So the kind of weather systems that we have, they're boring. There's this kind of rain for a couple days. Maybe you get some mudslides and that type of thing. And then coming out here to storm chase, it was like these storms are so alive with power. And to go underneath them, it just was just awe-inspiring to see that much kind of energy and power above you. So I was hooked the first couple of chases. I felt instantly head over heels in love with the whole storm chasing thing.
You couldn't get enough film.
Yeah. No. Oh, yeah. And when we first started chasing, we didn't, you know, we would rent minivans, right? You know, because we'd go to Enterprise or, maybe not Enterprise.
Unnamed
company we would rent from. We'd get the Dodge Caravans because we could throw all our IMAX gear in them. And then they have a return policy where you can, you know, you get your insurance and then you can return after hours and just park the vehicle in a spot and then leave the keys in a Dropbox and then maybe a note too. And that's it.
So I've talked to a lot of wildlife photographers and cinematographers, and there's a lot of, you know, kind of waiting, right, to get the perfect shot. You not only have to wait and hope you're in the right spot. I mean, it really is in some ways like finding a needle in a haystack, right? Because you could be in Oklahoma City and something could be happening in Fort Worth and you have to get yourself down there.
Well, you kind of chase the parameters that Don was talking about, you know, where that moisture intersects the wind. So you go to the area where you think has the best parameters in place for tornadoes to form. But, you know, there's always those times when, you know, you've picked the wrong spot, or it's a day in which it's, you know, the potential covers a whole state, and you can't cover a whole state, you know, being one chase team. So you miss a lot of opportunity, of course, you hear about. And that's the thing. You chase all day. Maybe usually you strike out, and then that night you go to your hotel room, and you see the news coverage of where the tornadoes actually happened, and you see everything you miss. And that's always kind of a little salt in the wound.
How do your teams organize, Don, and how are plans made about where people will go and where equipment gets deployed, that sort of thing?
Yeah. Sean sometimes does his chasing alone, but during Vortex 2, he sometimes, many times, chased with us. And Vortex 2 was a large field program, about 50 vehicles and about 150 people. So there were certainly logistics involved. We had a full-time logistics coordinator. And she spent her time looking for motel rooms for that many people and places where maybe we were big enough for to buy diesel fuel and bathroom stops and places to eat and all kinds of things like that. So it's a big job moving that many people around for a totally mobile experiment.
So as I mentioned, we've, and I don't know if you all have heard the news, but we've been dealing with some small earthquakes in this part of the country. People are looking at whether there may be some human causes involved. There are people who say that climate change and the human causes there might be playing a role in the incidence of severe weather. What do you think about that?
Well, the changes in climate over time produce different mixtures of those ingredients we talked about, the amount of moisture, the wind shear, and so forth. Our climate is warming. But it really hasn't warmed enough to dramatically change those elements. So at this time, I don't think climate change is a big player in events that we see. Tornado outbreaks are always rare events, and they don't occur all the time. You might be unlucky, like Moore, Oklahoma, and have several of them. But probably they're only going to occur once or twice in people's lifetimes for them to actually be affected. So for these rare events, it's really hard to pin them to climate change. But if our climate keeps warming, we will eventually see so much difference in those ingredients that the severe weather distributions will change. We'll have less of the instability that we currently have now, but we'll probably have more storms. And so who knows what might happen in a future climate state.
So early warning is obviously ideal, but right now there are, in the interest of caution, we end up hearing a lot of false warnings, right? Things that don't turn out to be a problem, and then people get complacent. So yeah. Can you talk about the importance of getting to a place where we can accurately say, okay, a storm is in your path and you are in imminent danger?
Well, Our situation now is we can see the general conditions that lead to tornadoes, and with Doppler radar, we can see the middle part of the storms, and we can see some rotation there. And so we have a better safe than sorry policy for our warnings. And that's why we have so many false alarms, because we get that rotation in the mid part of the storm a lot more than we get tornadoes on the ground. So it's the kind of thing that Sean does in Vortex 2 did, where we go out and really study in detail the storm to try to learn more about it. So hopefully we can find some keys for better warnings, more accurate, reliable warnings for the future.
Does it ever get less exciting to actually see a funnel cloud with your own eyes?
Oh, no. Well, it gets less exciting all the driving that you do, because we do, you know, you're doing 400 miles on average a day. That's what our team does. I mean, we drive and drive and drive. And, of course, that gets older and older as the years go by. But when you the conditions, you know, do come together and you do see that start of that, you know, that genesis of the tornado, that funnel cloud, and it starting to connect visually to the ground, that never gets old, no. And in our vehicle, you know, we're trying to get as close as possible. And so everybody's blood is getting up and, you know, the adrenaline is starting to flow and you're starting to witness something that is incredible.
Will you describe your vehicle? It looks to me like something like a cross between a military vehicle and something out of Mad Max. It is made to withstand incredibly severe conditions.
Well, yeah, going back to the minivan. So, of course, when we started chasing the whole minivan thing, you could only get so close to the tornado before it was time to bail out. And I felt, one, that we weren't getting close enough to get footage that did justice to what we were actually seeing. And so I decided to build a vehicle that we could stand our ground and get closer to the tornado to film it. And the closer you get, with these, you know, with the IMAX camera, with these wide angle lenses, the closer you get, the more detail, the more power you capture. And so I endeavored to learn to weld and fabricate and build what would become the Tornado Intercept vehicle. You know, it's this 16,000 pound armored. Yeah, it has a military vibe. But it also has that kind of like, you know, 1970s sci-fi, you know, the people have to cross the zombie-infested desert kind of set, you know, sci-fi look.
It is the perfect zombie apocalypse vehicle, actually.
Yeah, actually, you know, it's a multi-purpose tool. You know, tornadoes in the spring, hurricanes in the fall, and if there are zombies in the winter, we're set.
What's the gas mileage?
Oh, we get we have a diesel engine, a Cummins engine, and so we get, you know, 12 miles to the gallon. You know, we weigh 16,000 pounds, so we weigh 16,000 pounds. You know, we've got 2-inch thick armor for our walls. Our windows are 1.5-inch thick polycarbonate. You know, 4 layers of polycarbonate, bullet resistant stuff. So we're a lot of weight going down that highway, and we still manage 12 miles to the gallon.
Do you feel fearless in that vehicle?
Oh, no. The minute that vehicle starts to move, I pretty much built it. So mm-hmm. The minute we start moving at high speeds, I get anxious. You know,
it's your baby.
Yeah, well, I don't, you know, we're 16,000 pounds and we're going 80 miles down the highway, and then all of a sudden something, you know, on the drive out, I just drove out from L.A. to get here, and on the way out here, I had one of the airbags, the thing that seats the airbag. That's what we
ride on. The suspension.
The suspension, yeah. Mm-hmm. It give way. And so I'm driving along going 80, and then all of a sudden my steering wheel locks and I can't steer.
Yikes. I'm glad you made it safe.
Thank you.
Sean Casey is here. He's a filmmaker and storm chaser. Tornado Alley opens this weekend at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science. Donald Burgess is with us as well. He's a research scientist at the University of Oklahoma, and he's featured in the film. You can join our conversation about tornadoes by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The IMAX film Tornado Alley opens this weekend at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science. Joining us are a scientist featured in the film, Donald Burgess. He is a research scientist at the Cooperative Institute for Mesoscale Meteorological Studies at the University of Oklahoma. And filmmaker and storm chaser Sean Casey is here as well, along with, in the back of our building, his tornado intercept vehicle. If you'd like to see a picture of that vehicle, our Lindsay Connect has got one, and it is at kera.org/think, or you can check out my Twitter feed at Chris Boyd Think. So back to this question of tornadoes. Some are much stronger than others. Is it always obvious, Don, to meteorologists why certain cells produce these giant tornadoes and certain ones don't?
No, it's not obvious. Some of the storms that look like they might produce the biggest tornadoes don't produce any tornadoes at all. Maybe they have too much cold air and it blows out away from the storm and the rotation can't get organized at low levels. Sean and I see many storms like that. Then there's some other kind of smaller storm and doesn't look like much, but the ingredients are correct and it can produce and does produce a tornado. And occasionally those are big tornadoes. But most often the biggest, the violent tornadoes come when all the ingredients are maximized. And so we kind of have an idea, at least on the days and which area the storms might be in that are going to produce the big tornadoes.
Is there a relationship between the big bad hail storms that we're quite familiar with in this area and tornadoes? Should we assume that hail means a tornado is likely?
There's an association, but it's not sufficient. You're going to get large hail out of storms, supercell kind of storms, more often than you get tornadoes. But it is correct that a supercell that produces a tornado is probably going to produce large hail as well.
When there are multiple funnels in the sky, I guess in some ways for a storm chaser, that's an embarrassment of riches, but then you have to decide in which direction to go. How do you do that?
Well, usually when you see multiple funnels, they're usually coming out of the same locale. Mm-hmm. Usually they're multi-vortices that are coming down, and they will typically congeal into one visual tornado. You know what? For us, it's the trick of having the right road and having a storm that's moving at a decent clip, you know, not going too fast, not going too slow, and all those pieces coming together where we can get right next to them and film them. That takes a while. It takes a while to do. You know, we do about 20, 30,000 miles every spring, and it took me 9 years to actually get a shot of a tornado coming directly at us and impacting us. So it's a real difficult thing.
Did that moment, which I don't feel like I'm giving too much away, it's really the climax of the film, which is extraordinary, and it's what people go to see. Did it feel like you expected it to feel once you had experienced that?
Well, here's the thing, is that you say you're going to be doing this, you know, parking in front of a tornado and filming it coming directly at you and hitting you. And you've been saying that, and you've been thinking it for a long time. And then all of a sudden, you get what you wish for, and here comes the tornado. And there's that big gulp moment, like,
What have I done?
We asked for it, right? And here it's coming, and we said we're going to, so let's stay here, and it's too late to move anyway, and I hope everything works out. You know, because you can't test the vehicle that we're in. You can't test it for everything it might encounter, mm-hmm. every kind of type of debris it might encounter, what kind of winds it might encounter. So there's always that question mark in the back of your mind. So I'm apprehensive as it's approaching, and then when it hits us, there was a design problem with the turret, and it started trying to rhythmically, violently try and leave the actual vehicle. It was pounding away.
This is the turret where you have a camera mount.
Yeah, the turret. Yeah, we have a turret on top of the vehicle where the camera lives. And so that's what we film from. So we can film in any direction while we're moving or stopped. And I was busily actually wedging myself trying to hold on to the turret because the IMAX camera, which is in the turret, has just filmed the shot of it, the tornado hitting us. And if that turret leaves with the IMAX camera, one, there goes the shot, and two, my dad owns that camera.
And they're not cheap.
And they're not, yeah, and he doesn't have a second one. Mm-hmm. So
there might be some debris flying around.
Yeah, exactly. So not that I was doing much by holding on to the turret at the time, but at least I was, you know, doing something at the moment.
So all this is going on, and you know, you are hopefully as safe as you can be. A lot of people remember that a year and a half ago, three very experienced storm chasers were killed in Oklahoma. And so I have to ask this question about how you make decisions and what you're telling yourself with regard to this is in pursuit of science, this is in pursuit of journalism, and do you have to also ask yourself, am I just doing this? Am I kind of cowboying it because I've got to have this experience, and whether you've argued with loved ones about these things?
Well, yeah, the death of Tim and Paul Samaras and then Carl Jung, that changed everything for me. Mm-hmm. That took a lot of joy and thrill out of the experience. And we've changed the way we chase now. We no longer have the mission of going into tornadoes. We're using our vehicle, the TIV, as a platform to put pods in front of the tornado and then get out of the way. So we're kind of using the TIV as like a mobile storm shelter in case something bad happens. And we have these pods now that we, you know, you have to get out of the vehicle, grab a pod and hammer it into the ground, and then, you know, skedaddle.
What's on those pods? Excuse me for interrupting.
It's an anemometer. So mm-hmm. it's measuring wind speed and wind direction. You know, that's all we're measuring. But if you put, say, three instruments in the path, you might get an interesting data set. If you have 3 points that tornado is encountering, or those are those three spots that are encountering what those winds are like at three different locales as that tornado goes over them, that could be an interesting data set if it's, you know, if we're underneath some radar that's seeing what's happening above us.
I think the key and what we all struggle with is situational awareness. And so not every storm, not every tornado is probably one that we should approach. That May 31st storm near El Reno, Oklahoma last year was definitely a kind of storm that can do so much that maybe it's one to back away from. And I know Sean has backed away, maybe even from that storm. I know some of us that were out there chasing that day backed away. And so I think that as we maintain situational awareness, we still have a margin of safety in what we're doing. But as Sean has said, the death of these very good and knowledgeable storm chasers who knew everything about situational awareness.
These were not daredevils.
We're not doing this for the thrill of seeing the tornado or trying to get in the tornado. I think there are some that do that, but I don't think Sean or I or the people participating in Vortex 2, people are continuing this research that we do, are doing it for that. We're doing it to get data, photographic data, digital data, wind data, and learn more about these tornadoes. And as we learn more about them, we might be able to issue better warnings in the future. So we're going to continue doing what we're doing, but we're going to try to do it still with a margin of safety. And we always tell the participants in our program that the biggest threat is an automobile accident on the way to the storm or on the way home, not being in the storm itself. But that doesn't mean that the storm isn't threatening, and we do have to maintain that margin of safety with situational awareness.
I'm enough of a fraidy cat that I can enjoy the film and sort of vicariously have an adventure watching it, and that's enough for me. Do you worry, though, that some people will see works like this and not understand how much preparation, how much caution, how many decisions go into a project like this and head out there without really knowing what they're doing?
Yeah, well, I think there's always people are going to be influenced by what they see. And, you know, we were doing a TV show, Storm Chasers, for a number of years. And I think there were a lot more people on the road because of that influence that, hey, look, you know, if these guys can do it, and it looks like a fun adventure, and it's in my own backyard, and they go out and do it. I don't have any control over that. I would just hope that people who do decide to do it, that they just don't jump in their car and go head off towards the storm. That, you know, they partner with somebody, they find somebody that knows that's been chasing before, somebody that's got experience, and then to go into the whole situation very slowly, not to be chasing in front of the storm, giving it a wide berth type thing.
What kind of driving skills are required for a good storm chaser?
Well, being calm, I think, and not getting rattled is one thing.
I'm out.
Yeah, you get rattled. Yeah, no, not getting rattled because, you know, and being very, like Don said, situationally aware of what's happening around you and having a head on a swivel to really monitor what the other vehicles are doing. Because you might have a situation where things are becoming extremely intense. People are focusing on a tornado. You have 50, 60 other vehicles out there chasing on the same road as you, and they're looking at that tornado too. And the conditions are getting wet, and there's hail, and who knows? People might freak out, and you see that stuff. You see people jacking U-turns just over a rise in the road, or you see, you know, questionable stuff. And for a driver to always be aware and hypersensitive to what other people might do, so that they can react as quickly as they can.
Experience is a help. Mm-hmm. If you've done it for a while, you kind of anticipate maybe what some other chasers out there might do, or what the storm itself might do.
Don, your teams are not driving specifically into the storms, but you get pretty close, and you guys aren't in particularly fortified vehicles, right?
No, and we do drive in the storms, just not in the tornado, right, like Sean is capable of doing. We have problems with the large hail. It can be damaging. During Vortex 2, lost something like 60 windshields, 60 different windshields, and one particular vehicle lost windshields 3 days in a row. Hmm. So hail is a big threat, and the heavy rain, loss of visibility, and everyone had a set job, a location to be. Some people were deploying pods like Sean is deploying now. We deployed some of those in Vortex 2 ahead of the storm. So it was kind of a choreography, everybody doing all these things to gather data underneath the storm, but staying away from the tornado. And one advantage we have that these people who go out to chase on their own don't have is we have mobile radars. And those radars give us up-to-date information. So we can help guide Sean. We can help guide all of those other teams that are out there underneath the storm.
Is crowdsourcing via social media of any value to people who do this professionally? Is there any value to people who are on Twitter and sort of reporting what they're experiencing? It's okay to say no. I'm just curious.
No, perhaps. There is a project we have in Norman with the University of Oklahoma and the National Severe Storms Laboratory. It's called Precipitation Types in Winter. And we covet social media interaction. All the National Weather Service offices across the country and other places advertise a program where you can get on social media and report the kind of severe winter weather you're experiencing. And that's definitely useful because we don't send chase teams out for winter storms. Yet for some of our radar work, we need verification. When it comes to tornadoes, it's not quite as useful. They're changing so quickly. Yeah. And actually, the members of the public sometimes are confused about the cloud forms they see. And occasionally, you might get a report. If you believed it, you'd do something. And if the report isn't correct, then you've done the wrong thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of overusage of large, violent tornado in reporting what's happening.
Well, if it's bearing down on you, I guess it always feels large and violent, but from a scientific perspective, that may not be accurate.
Yeah. I think people get caught up in the emotion and, you know, a wedge tornado. There's some inflationary descriptions out there. Hmm. Let's just say.
How do you, Sean, audition crew members? Because some of the skills that they really need to have when you're in the moment are things you can't necessarily test for, I guess.
I thought you said you were kind of a sketchy driver.
Am I a sketchy driver? Well, I'm not a sketchy driver. I get
rattled,
nervous.
Rattled,
I get
rattled,
rattled if
rattled.
There's crazy weather and things going on.
You know what? I haven't. Yeah, it's finding people that have a passion for it,
mm-hmm.
And that you think are going to remain calm. We've had people though that you think are going to remain calm, they seem capable and that they would keep their heads, but they start to lose it a little bit. And if you lose it just a little bit, you make a mistake. It's calm, and people you get along with, of course, too. You're going to be spending 2 months on the road living in a vehicle for 14 hours a day, and you want to be able to get along because,
yeah,
you know, just that kind of mileage you're going to be spending with that person, you're going to have your problems regardless.
Is it the same for meteorologists?
Well, people with experience are always best. We have a lot of graduate students, a lot of very excited and ambitious young people who are studying meteorology and inquisitive about all these things, and they want to go out there and study them, and that's great, and we use that. But we have to sometimes temper their enthusiasm, and we try to put them with experienced people. And those young folks quickly grow up, and then they get the experience, and then they can help train the next batch of graduate students that's coming next year.
Have you all ever seen a waterspout?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I like to look at them in photographs. Do they feel different than seeing a regular tornado when you're witnessing one?
Waterspouts are a form of tornadoes. Mm-hmm. They come in all different sizes, shapes, and forms.
It's a tornado that touches down on water.
Touches down on water. You can have them on lakes, but they're most common in shallow bays and estuaries, in coastal areas around oceans. They're usually not as strong as our most violent Great Plains tornadoes. So in that way, we kind of see them as maybe weaker sisters in part, but they're tornadoes just like all the others.
And then they can, I guess, do they recede? Is that what happens to a tornado? Essentially, it just sort of is pulled back up into the cloud that produced it?
Well, it's this column of air that's driven by pressure forces. And mm-hmm. as those pressure forces weaken, and some of that comes from temperature contrast, and you mix the air up and you reduce the temperature contrast, and then the pressure forces reduce, and then that very strong spin that in a tight diameter just kind of gets less spin and a broader diameter, and it just diffuses.
We're speaking this hour with meteorologist Donald Burgess of the University of Oklahoma and filmmaker and storm chaser Sean Casey. Tornado Alley, his film, opens this weekend at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with filmmaker and storm chaser Sean Casey and Donald Burgess, who's a research scientist at the Cooperative Institute for Mesoscale Meteorological Studies at the University of Oklahoma. The film Tornado Alley opens this weekend at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science, and you can meet Sean and Don Saturday at the Perot. They will introduce the film at 10:15 and 11:15, and then they will be on the parking lot with the Tornado Intercept Vehicle, which, I tell you, is something to see, from 12:30 to 2 p.m. And I love that I have in my notes here, it says weather permitting. So you'll be out there no matter what, but I guess an outdoor event may not be called for.
Well, you know, there's lots of room in the TIV.
You can keep people safe in there, but not warm.
Yeah, no, there's no heater in the TIV. I'm just now getting feeling back in my toes after about 6 hours of freezing.
Why did you not put a heater in there? Or an air conditioner, I should
say.
Well,
it takes, they're big units.
Mm-hmm.
And, I get a lot. I should have left it in. I don't know what we were thinking. But we took it out because it was such a large area. It was taking up too much room, and we took it out. And usually when you chase, you know, the temperature extremes aren't that bad. And it's nice to have AC, though. But
Cross-country trip is another thing in January.
Cross-country trip, yeah, in January. Luckily, I was on the 10, you know, not the 70 or the 90.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to David in Plano. Hey, David.
Hi, another great show as always.
Thanks.
I had a question. I'm one of the many storm spotters that operate in the Dallas area, at least, and there's different groups of them throughout the U.S., up and down Tornado Alley. I was curious to know, when you guys go out in the field, do you have a lot of activity or coordination with the storm spotter groups, or do you guys pretty much operate independently on your own?
Thanks for your call.
We sometimes have interaction with spotter groups through amateur radio, because a few of our vehicles have amateur radio capability. The folks have taken upon themselves to get licenses, and then they can participate. But typically we don't, because we're so busy with our internal communication that there just isn't much time. Now, National Weather Service offices have a lot of communication with the spotters, of course, and we rely on that then, being in communication with the National Weather Service, to get the advantage of all of those good spotter reports without talking to the spotters directly.
What does a tornado sound like when you were outside in a rural area and not, inside a building and feeling that and hearing that move?
Oh, they make lots of different sounds, actually. There could be, it's mainly like a large waterfall. Like if you're next to the Niagara Falls and having that large rushing power, yeah. Do you want me to go for it?
Yeah, please. Like,
that kind of sound. Mm-hmm. And then if it's picking up larger debris, then they'll have more of a rumble. And so when people describe, like a freight train going near or over them, then yeah, I think they're usually describing that, they were in the town when it happened and that tornado was picking up a lot of large debris and creating that rumble. And then little tornadoes, little subvortices, they'll make little hissing sounds when they start to form up. And you might be driving under subvortices and you'll just hear these kind of like this all around you. And those are these little subvortices happening. So they make lots of different sounds.
Do you have anything to add to that?
Nope, not much.
No, you don't want to. Yeah, go for it.
That low-frequency roar is, of course, probably the most dramatic thing in what people talk about. And Sean's exactly right. We've done a lot of studies of audio recordings and the different frequencies of sound, and that rumble is coming from the debris interaction with the ground and pieces of debris hitting other pieces of debris.
People, when there are not tragic losses of life and property, people love the crazy stories of things that got picked up and moved. I wonder how many of these are real and how many are apocryphal, and whether either of you has tried to sort of verify some of these or if you have a favorite.
Well, there are lots of stories, and sometimes they are true. I've seen straw driven into wood. But it's also true with lowered pressure that the wood tends to expand and produces little openings that the straw can penetrate. So it's, some reasonable explanation and some, wow, look at that kinds of stuff. I've seen vinyl records, the old kinds of records we used to have driven into wood and other things. And that's just the power of the wind. They're moving so fast that they're able to penetrate in. But there are also stories that, probably get embellished, or they just happen to think that maybe it occurred because of the tornado, but it didn't. I was on a damage survey once, and I was away from a group of houses out in a field, and I happened to look over on a fence line, and there were several shirts on hangers just stuck on the fence. And your first thought is, wow, the tornado just dropped those and strung them out on the fence. And then I happened to talk to a person who was over by a house not far away, and he said, yeah, I found some of my shirts out there and put them on hangers and put them on the fence. So you have to check out the stories, and some things are really unbelievable with tornadoes, but other times there is an explanation.
Trust but verify. Let's go back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We have Marco on the line in Dallas. Hey, Marco.
Good afternoon, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for your guests, and it's a great topic, by the way. Was wondering if y'all cringe when you watch movies, typical Hollywood movies like Twister. And for me, that final scene when they chain themselves to a wellhead was not very realistic, but I'd like your thoughts.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I like Twist. I'm a bit. I like Bill Paxton. I like that. I like him as an actor. In fact, he narrates Tornado Alley. And some of the tornadoes. I mean, that was what, 1996 that Twister came out, mm-hmm. and for the CG effects they did a pretty good job. But of course, you know, if you're going to see a cow float by, and it's close enough that you can see the facial expression of the cow, you know, you just take that as, you know, Hollywood storytelling. The one thing is that, you know, Hollywood special effects kind of influenced my film in that, you know, people expect when they go to see a film about, you know, something like tornadoes, that they see the tornadoes and they see amazing, crazy things happening. They see the cow fly by. They see things explode. They see trees, you know. So in a way, as a documentary filmmaker, we were having to kind of, in a way, compete with that and to actually mimic what, you know, you can do in a computer in a Hollywood film, but doing it in real life by getting as close as possible.
That has to be frustrating when you think, this is real. People have no idea how many years of my life I spent to get this amazing shot.
Yeah. You do. And you know, but that's what you got to do. But for me, too, you know, it wasn't just about, you know, trying to make outdo what you couldn't outdo. It was, you know, being as close as possible and filming something extremely difficult to film and visually out of this world, and to capture that in the IMAX format and share that with a larger audience. I mean, that was the most precious thing about the whole journey.
What about you, Don?
Well, I kind of agree with the caller. Some of the things you see in the movies do cause you to cringe occasionally or ask yourself, you know, I wonder why they didn't do it differently. When Michael Crichton and his wife got the idea for Twister, they came to Norman and worked with us because they got the idea from a device we were trying to deploy in front of tornadoes, something we call Toto. And so we saw the script and we had ability to make some comments. Sometimes they would take our comments and sometimes they didn't. Again, as the caller mentioned, that conclusion where they used the belt to tie themselves in the shed to the wellhead and they're able to survive and the debris did not tear them apart, which it would have done, that's Hollywood. When they're able to stop and go to Aunt Em's house and have a shower and a meal and rest up and then go out and chase again, that's Hollywood. That certainly never happened to me, and I bet it hasn't happened to Sean. So in the end, you have to accept when they're going to make a movie, it's going to have a Hollywood element, and that's what makes good movies, but not everything in it is going to be accurate.
Don, you don't live in this market, so I'm not going to put you on the spot, but I'm curious about if you're ever home when there is bad weather and you flip on the television, are there qualities that you like to see or that you respect and think are important in like a TV meteorologist, which is how a lot of people get their weather information?
Yes, people do get their information from television, and the television media does a great job. It does in Oklahoma City market, where I'm from. I actually live in Norman. I'm not at home most of the time, but I do sometimes see that coverage, and I know here in Dallas-Fort Worth you have very good coverage. My daughter and family used to live in this area. I think experience is important. I think the ability to communicate well and the tools that television has now. In addition to having access to the National Weather Service radars, they have their own radars. They have people they send out, and in some cases even helicopters that fly in the sky and see the storm. And probably nothing communicates as well as the real-time image from a helicopter or a storm intercept vehicle on the ground, that here is the tornado and it looks violent and it looks scary. That really motivates people to take shelter.
You think drones, Sean, are going to be a way that we get a lot of these images in the future?
God, drones? I don't know. Drones?
You don't have a drone yet with your dad's IMAX camera strapped to it?
Yeah, yeah. I'm kind of anti-drone right now because you go to, like, the beach, and then all of a sudden there's a drone flying above you. Or you go to, like, you know, a concert, and all of a sudden there's a drone. They're distracting and they're noisy. And maybe I'm just getting old, but I don't like drones. But who's to say, man? Maybe one day I'll love drones.
We use some drones in Vortex 2. They're not featured in the film because we really didn't use them much. They were newer back in 2009 and 2010. But there's also a lot of restrictions. If you work with the FAA and with the Department of Homeland Security, as you must, to fly drones, if they're very big and might have the power to withstand storm winds, then there aren't very many places that you can fly them. and there's a lot of requirements. It's hoped in meteorology, in research, that drones will help us, and we can find some ways to use them and collect data. Not to fly into storms, not to fly into tornadoes, but to fly at the edges probably can get some good information. So I think that they do have a future, but it is a balance between that security that we need to maintain and then not being intrusive. As Sean says, you don't want to fly over people's house and photograph them.
Yeah, there was actually, I think, a report of this last spring of a tornado had gone through, I think it was Arkansas, and then there was a drone that was hovering over the aftermath, and, you know, you had police and you had fire personnel, you know, trying to do search and rescue, and then here's all of a sudden a drone that's, you know, what's this drone doing, mm-hmm. you know? So it became, you know, a bit of a distraction.
Sean, as the film starts, the documentary Tornado Alley, we follow the meteorologist on Don's team, but we also follow you on your journey mm-hmm. to get this amazing shot and sort of be within the tornado. And we have this idea that, you know, if you can just get this shot, then you'll be done. And it seems like you're so not done with any of this.
Well, yeah. I swear this is the last spring I chased. This is the last one. No, I'm actually doing another IMAX film. It's called Extreme Weather. And so it's about hurricanes, tornadoes, and wildfire, and how the warming of our Earth might be affecting these types of things and what we could possibly expect in the future. So we are chasing with that. We're chasing tornadoes to put pods in the path. So I'm not done, but I've got two young girls and a wife, and it gets harder and harder every year.
Do they, is it hard for you ever to show them what you've just collected, knowing that they're going to put the pieces together and recognize that you were in a place that was pretty dicey?
I don't think my kids really realize. I mean, it's one thing to show imagery, but then for them to really know that it was dangerous. There was, two springs ago, we got into a tornado that was pretty heavy, and it was by mistake. We got on a mud road. It was a field access road. And we lost all traction. You know, we're stuck in the mud. And then here comes this tornado, and we had to deploy. And it wasn't by choice. And it was a very heavy moment. We were getting pelted. It was like a blackout. There was so much debris. And I thought an electrical line had fallen on the back of the vehicle. There was this sparking. I thought we were being electrocuted because of all the sparkling. But it was from the ricochets, objects ricocheting off the vehicle. We had a hatch blow open during. We had chunks of wood, 1 pound. Chunks of wood in the vehicle. So we did shoot video of that, but I would never show that to my kids, not that video. You pick and choose with kids, right?
Exactly. Guys, thank you so much for being here. I've really appreciated the conversation. The film Tornado Alley will open on at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science this weekend. Sean Casey is the filmmaker, and Donald Burgess is a meteorologist from the University of Oklahoma. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.